should be tearing down buildings. We should look at structures and locations that are of low value and are not generating.
The outgoing University of Alaska president talks about surviving lean budget years. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, December 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, scientists learn more about the ancient coastline of Southeast Alaska.
If you and I would have been 10,000 years ago on the shoreline and we lived to be 50 years old, sea level would have rose 10.2 feet in our lifetime.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
An Alaska grand jury has indicted a 47-year-old man accused of shooting a prosecutor in a jealous rage over a woman. Ronald Fisher is charged with first and second degree murder in the December 8th shotgun death of 48-year-old Brian Sullivan, who was an assistant district attorney in Barrow. Authorities say Sullivan was shot at the home of a woman who had children in a past relationship with Fisher. The indictment also charges Fisher with assault by placing the woman in fear with a shotgun. The indictment was handed up yesterday by a grand jury in Nome because Sullivan had been presenting cases to a grand jury in Barrow. Alaska Governor Bill Walker says he's considering a 90-day delay in implementing legal marijuana sales. Alaska voters in November approved legalizing recreational use of marijuana. The Fairbanks Daily News Miner reports Walker told the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce he's exploring a delay in the part of the measure that allows for commercial sales. Supporters of the initiative say they would challenge a delay, saying the ballot language laid out clear timelines. The ballot measure specified that adults no longer would be arrested under state law for possessing up to an ounce of marijuana outside their homes 90 days after election results were certified. That date is February 24th. The state has 9 months more to produce regulations for commercial sales, 3 months to begin accepting applications, and 3 months after that to issue permits. Commercial growers could produce marijuana for sale in May 2016 under the timeline. University of Alaska President Pat Gamble is anticipating budget cuts that will force the institution to downsize and focus on its core missions. Gamble plans to retire at the end of the 2015 school year, but as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, he's looking beyond his tenure to help the university prepare for the future.
University of Alaska President Pat Gamble will be exiting the institution as it undergoes a major transformation, driven by declining oil revenues that are carving into state support for the school, starting with what Gamble describes as a hard landing this year.
Trying to cover $28 million in 15 and then turn right around in 16 and cover at least that much again, and then do it again in 17 and do it again in 18. Where do you find those millions of dollars on a year-to-year-to-year basis?
The answer, according to Gamble, involves changes to the very structure of the university.
We should be tearing down buildings. We should look at structures and locations that are of low value and are not generating, and we're paying high costs. So there's the physical side. Then there's the academic side, in which we have a large program offering for students to come in and take all these different programs at the three universities, which clearly is going to be unaffordable.
Gamble points to 10 years of what he calls uncontrolled growth at the university and identifies the challenge now as tightening up around core programs.
The things that are our niche, we're Arctic-oriented, we're resource-oriented, we're environmentally-oriented, we're research-oriented in a number of areas, collapse around this core. And we keep it vibrant and vital through the tough years so that at the end, when we come out of this thing, we have a foundation that we can again bloom off of and grow.
Gamble says the University of Alaska is better positioned than in the past to deal with the situation because campus leaders are working together, something he considers a high point of his five-year tenure as UA president.
A cooperative atmosphere where the rising tide floats all the boats instead of competition.
President Gamble emphasizes that the public will be part of the University of Alaska restructuring process, pointing to a Board of Regents session scheduled for next month to review options that will be open open to the public. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The $1 trillion spending plan passed by Congress last weekend and signed by President Obama includes money for wildfire mitigation and management. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, that budget is up from prior years.
The omnibus spending plan includes $1.4 billion for wildfire management and mitigation,
which is about $64 million above fiscal year 2014 enacted level.
That's Kent Slaughter. He's the manager of the Bureau of Land Management's Alaska Fire Service.
So it is. There is definitely an increase in the amount appropriated.
The money is based on a 10-year average funding level, but it's not allocated by state. It'll be split between the United States Forest Service and the Department of Interior, which oversees the BLM. Slaughter says $804 million will go to the DOI, but it'll be another month or two before he knows exactly how much funding will go to the Alaska Fire Service.
I think that the process went as the process is going to go. In terms of, it would be nice to have a budget prior to the start of the fiscal year, but beyond that, it's nice to have a budget to know, hopefully within the next month or so, where we'll be for the rest of the fiscal year.
The federal budget for wildfire management has been strained in recent years. According to the Forest Service, the wildfire season in the United States has increased by between 60 and 80 days in the last 30 years. When the president proposed his fiscal year 2015 budget earlier this summer, it included a proposal to create an emergency fund for catastrophic wildfires. The goal was to decrease the amount of money that's pulled from other programs like forest restoration and management, as well as research. But during the congressional process, that proposal was scrapped. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, childhood friends and hockey players come together for the 5th annual Christmas Classic.
You know, it started to progress, and the third year we ended up having 60. And at that point, it's like, you know, hey, all these guys are coming together. We got to do it for something more. We got to do it for a cause.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Fish Basket Coalition, working to secure a bright future for Bristol Bay and the Bering Sea, where fishing means business. Visit fishbasket.org to learn more.
And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com.
The Earth's crust is more flexible than you think, especially in Southeast Alaska. Growing and shrinking ice fields and glaciers, rising and falling oceans have altered the region's coastline over time. Understanding those changes is helping scientists to learn more about the area's early human habitation. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports from a recent lecture in Juneau.
We've all pretty much grown up with the assumption that the land we live on is where it's been for thousands of years. Sure, we have volcanoes and earthquakes, and if you paid attention in school, plate tectonics, but the big stuff happened millions of years ago, right? Wrong. In this part of the world, drastic changes have happened in the past 5 to 15,000 years. Forest Service geologist Jim Bechtel explains.
The ice came out on the landscape, it pushed down on that land, the sea reinvaded as the ice started to melt, and now that land has risen up. So what it gives us is an idea of the timing of deglaciation.
He knows that because he and others have been mapping shell beds. They've been found from below today's shorelines to hundreds of feet above. Once you figure out where the shore used to be, you can make an educated guess of where early inhabitants lived and what they saw.
If you and I would have been 10,000 years ago on the shoreline and we lived to be 50 years old, sea level would have rose 10.2 feet in our lifetime.
That, by the way, matches some oral history. The information means scientists have found numerous settlements and followed them as they moved up and down rivers and streams as the ocean rose and fell. Scientists have found campsites with tools and other signs of occupation. Bechtel says they include agate and obsidian, which is only found in a few areas.
So these people had been on the landscape long enough to find all those sites and develop trade back and forth from those sites throughout all of Southeast Alaska by 10,500 calendar years ago.
The findings have larger implications for the region's human history. For example, Bechtel says flooding could have made it easier for early inhabitants to travel.
So when people were coming into southeast Alaska, they might not have been paddling down rivers, they were coming down the fjords.
And once they arrived, travel would have been more on the water than the land.
Admiralty Island was a multitude of islands. If you look at Cleveland Peninsula and stuff, it was a multitude of islands. Same with Gravina Island and Annette Island outside of Ketchikan.
Bechtel and other scientists have continued expanding their discoveries. He says before 2009, only 5 early settlement sites had been located. Since this type of research began, 17 more have been added to the list. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
In A Dangerous Idea, author Peter Metcalf looks at the crucial role the Alaska Native Brotherhood played in securing Native rights and land claims before, during, and after statehood. The recently published book explores an often overlooked chapter in Alaska's history. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
When the Alaska Native Brotherhood formed in 1912, Alaska Natives were not U.S. citizens, couldn't own title to land, and couldn't send their children to local schools. The aim of the group was citizenship and equality. Peter Metcalf says AMB was starting to make progress in the 1920s.
They had won rights for education, voting rights, but what is consistent throughout the history of the Alaska Native Brotherhood is their demand that they be equals with the white establishment, that they have what we now call civil rights, and that wasn't even a term at that time.
Two important leaders of the A&B in the 1920s were Peter Simpson and William Paul. Cultural expert and storyteller Ishmael Hope recounts an exchange they had during the 1925 A&B convention. Hope says Simpson
went up to William Paul, who was one of the very prominent young leaders of the time, and he just quietly said to him, "Hey, Willie, who owns this land?" And then there was a little bit of a pause as William Paul thought of it, and then he said, "Well, we do. Then fight for it."
By the 1929 AMB-ANS Grand Camp Convention in Haines, Paul was grand president. Metcalf says Paul invited James Wickersham, who had served as a district judge and Alaska's delegate to Congress.
Judge Wickersham made a presentation to this convention in which he told the assembled delegates of the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Alaska Native Sisterhood that they could sue the U.S. government.
During his time in D.C., Wickersham had seen Congress pass different jurisdictional acts, allowing various Native American groups to sue the government over lost lands and rights. AMB and ANS voted to do just that. Kathy Ruddy helped Metcalf with research for the book. She says that moment in history was the genesis of the book's title.
The dangerous idea is suing your own government when you've only been citizens for 5 years. The citizenship was extended to the Native people in 1924, and this is just 5 years after that.
Metcalf says it was a landmark decision. In the early 1930s, A&B began fighting for Aboriginal land claims in D.C. Metcalf says members of the A&B set aside traditional ways in order to achieve their goals. Leaders spoke English and adapted to Western ways of dress and social activities. But Hope says, despite what they wore at the time, leaders of the A&B, like his grandfather, John Hope, retained their native culture, which helped them in their fight.
My grandpa talked about how we used parliamentary procedure. We used the English language as a tool, but not a means of identity. Many of the A&B founders, you look at them and you think the stereotype is that they're assimilated Indians. But you actually look into the history and you see deeply retained cultural knowledge, cultural experience.
Hope's father, Andrew Hope III, was the impetus for A Dangerous Idea. It was his idea to apply for a grant through the Alaska Humanities Forum, which funded the research. Hope passed away shortly after the grant was awarded in 2008. One important case stemming from that 1929 decision, Tlingit and Haida Indians of Alaska versus the United States, took about 40 years to resolve. In 1968, a federal court held that the land was owned by Native people from time immemorial. Metcalf says without the AMB and the ANS, there wouldn't have been an Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971, an Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act of 1980, or the Alaska of today. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Climber and Arctic veteran Lonnie Dupree left Talkeetna yesterday for his fourth attempt to be the first person to summit Denali in January. KTNA's Philip Manning has the story.
Climbing Denali is hard. Even in peak season, temperatures dip below zero and frostbite is a real concern. In fact, this summer saw one of the lowest summit rates in decades, owing largely to the weather. Not many people attempt North America's highest peak in the winter. Lonnie Dupree is one of the few who has. He's just left on his fourth winter attempt of Denali and hopes to summit by the end of January. His previous attempts were all thwarted by the weather. Dupree says he's surprised at how mild the Alaskan winter has been so far.
I'm surprised on how little snow and how warm it's been in Alaska overall. I mean, that's opens up a whole new bit of news maybe on climate change and what's going on with the weather these days.
Lonnie Dupree takes climate change seriously. Many of his expeditions have been to raise awareness for the changing environment. Despite the warmer-than-normal temperatures in the lowlands of Alaska, however, Dupree says it will still be very cold on Denali, with temperatures potentially dipping to 50 below zero. Under those conditions, Lonnie Dupree says the body requires a lot of calories just to keep going.
It's like throwing a log on the fire, right? You got to keep the firewood coming when you're up there. So that's very, very important.
Lonnie Dupree estimates he'll be taking in about 4,500 calories per day to keep his internal furnace running. Even so, he expects to come back 15 pounds lighter than when he left. He says that hydration is even more important and that he plans to drink 4 or 5 liters of melted snow water each day. Daylight is also a major factor affecting winter climbs. Lonnie Dupree will only have a handful of hours each day to try to make progress.
A big challenge is, aside from the cold, is you only have a limited amount of time to travel because it's dark. I'm leaving darkest time of the year, so it only leaves you maybe 5 hours of usable light in mid-December.
Crevasses present a challenge to Denali climbers regardless of the season. Without team members, Lonnie Dupree will be on his own should he find himself in an area where crevasses have opened.
As a preventative measure to not drop into one of those bad boys is to take a big long pair of skis, and I'm taking a spruce pole, about a 13-foot-long spruce pole with me.
Like much of his gear, Lonnie's 8-foot-long skis are custom. In fact, he made them himself. This year, he's also bringing along a tent, sleeping bag, and down suit that should help him stay warm. Overall, Dupree feels good about this year's attempt.
You always get those butterflies in your stomach right before you go, but I'm excited to get moving. I'm feeling really good about this year. I've trained hard. I have all the equipment that I could wish for, for this trip.
As with his previous attempts, Lonnie Dupree's primary goal is to get back safely. So reaching the summit of Denali would be a definite plus. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Artisanal Specialty Foods, Alaskan-made specialty food gift baskets featuring small-batch food producers from around the state. All products include shipping within the United States. Online at alaskaartisanal.com.
Alaska Pacific University offers the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. Deadline to apply is March 1st, 2015. Alaska Pacific University is a private nonprofit offering small class sizes with a student-centered approach in the arts and sciences. More at 1-800-252-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka, Chugiak,
Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Kayla DeRoche. This week on AK, hockey homecoming. Anchorage has a close-knit hockey community, but if players want to continue onto college hockey or eventually play professionally, they have to move away from Alaska at a fairly young age, leaving friendships behind. They use their short breaks back home to relive some of those childhood memories on the ice. And as APRN's Josh Edge reports, the fifth annual Christmas Classic gives them that opportunity.
Tanner Sorensen is flying around the ice at Anchorage's Bonnie Cusack's outdoor rinks. He rings a shot off the goalpost, watching it sail high over the boards, narrowly missing a car park nearby. He flew into Anchorage early this morning from Michigan State University, where he's playing his final year of college hockey. Though Tanner enjoys playing on a larger stage with high pressure to perform in front of thousands of fans, he says getting back on the outdoor ice is relaxing.
Just get to have fun, do whatever you want, mess around. No one's going to get too upset. I mean, obviously everyone's so competitive with hockey and sports in general. But outside of that, there's no systems, no pressure. So I think it's just everyone can have a good time and kind of get together with your buddies when you come back from school and whatnot, which is always fun.
Tanner has been living halfway across the country since he started high school. As he was entering ninth grade, he was recruited to play hockey at Minnesota's Shattuck St. Mary's, a prep school with a reputation of churning out future college hockey and professional stars. Now on Michigan State's roster, Tanner says the transition to living away from home during his early teenage years wasn't too difficult, but it meant leaving behind a lifetime of friends. So whenever he makes it back up to Alaska, he takes advantage of the time he has to reconnect.
We always get together, come out here, have some fun, mess around, kind of enjoy being back. I mean, it's nothing serious. We're just like I guess it's a time to get away, hang out, rest, catch up on what we missed, how school's going, how we're doing, and all that.
Of course, leaving the state to play high school hockey also meant leaving his family. Tanner's dad is Dennis Sorensen, who is well known in Alaska's hockey community. He's been coaching in the state since 1984 after finishing his collegiate career at the University of Alaska Anchorage. I meet Dennis at another local ice rink where he's coaching Anchorage's Diamond High School. During his time coaching, Dennis has helped hundreds of players go on to compete at hockey's highest levels. And he says it's important for the players to get back on the outdoor ice where they started to put a smile back on their face and to remind themselves of why they love the game.
Sometimes the team game, the team takes over for the fun because winning is really important. So they get out there and it doesn't matter if they win or lose. They're out there doing moves they haven't done in years and they just feel like, you know, the best thing's going on in the world. Nobody's yelling at them. Nobody cares. They're just having a good time with their friends and doing something positive.
The Sorensen story is common in Alaska's hockey community. Bryce Christensen is another player who grew up in Alaska, but eventually had to leave to further his hockey career. He is the founder and organizer of the Christmas Classic Outdoor Hockey Tournament. Bryce says it started off small as a way to get some friends together who had gone their separate ways for junior and college hockey.
You know, first year, idea was just to see how many guys we can get together to come out and play some hockey. And, you know, first year we went on Facebook and got 20 guys together. Next year we got 40 guys and then, you know, it started to progress and the third year we ended up having 60. And at that point it's like, you know, hey, all these guys are coming together. We got to do it for something more. We got to do it for a cause.
That cause ended up being Toys for Tots. Last year, the tournament fielded 96 players and contributed 208 toys. This year, it's even bigger with more than 125 players signed up to play. Both Dennis and Tanner are participating in this year's tournament. Tanner says it'll be nice to get back out on the ice with old friends, even if he already plays against some of them in college.
It's kind of funny. You'll get there, line up against someone, give them a nice little slash on the back or whatever, and kind of laugh it off. But definitely when the puck's going, it's kind of all in. Everyone's so serious, you don't even realize that's your buddy until the end of the game. So it's definitely fun to get back and kind of talk about the games we've played against each other and whatnot. So I know everyone's pretty excited to come to this tournament.
As the tournament expands, its goal is to be a family event. This year, there will be a heating tent, free food and drinks. Bryce is even trying to get a Santa for the kids and some live music for those who stop by. There will also be Marines standing by for toy drop-offs and, of course, some great hockey. For AK, I'm Josh Edge in Anchorage.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to the Bering Sea community of Kipnuk.
Jimmy Paul, I'm a tribal administrator in Chum. Eskimo name Kipnuk, and they call it Kipnuk. It means river bend. The village used to be down there about a mile south of Kipnuk, and after big flood. They were some old people surveyed, and it was, Kipnik was the only high ground. That's how they move. But before that, there was how many houses, maybe two or three mud houses before they move. Oh, it's very soft wetland and a lot of lakes around us. Oh, we like to do a carnival and inspirations here. We make black fish trap, seal hunting, and play a basketball tournament. In springtime, we go seal hunting, gather meat and seal oil. And summertime, when summertime starts coming, we go out fishing, like herring, halibut, salmon. It's hard to get the salmon sometimes. Depends on tide and weather condition. It's a home. That's the main thing, and we like the environment. We have a freedom here to live.
Jimmy Paul is the tribal administrator in Kipnuk. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Josh Edge, Ashley Snyder, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Barras and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld and Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to health care. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.